Richard Russo isn't known for sequels, so he's broken new ground with his latest novel, Everybody's Fool, in which he returns to North Bath, the fictional upstate New York setting of his 1993 novel, Nobody's Fool. There we reunite with his hard-living, down-on-his-luck protagonist, Sully. Richard Russo lives in Portland, Maine, and in this book and others, he's drawn to the foibles of small-town living. He was also drawn to the portrayal of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman of one character in the film version of Nobody's Fool that also starred Paul Newman, and that's the hapless police officer named Raymer. Richard Russo is the author of 7 previous novels, and in 2002, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls, which became the award-winning HBO miniseries. And Richard, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
How much influence did Philip Seymour Hoffman's portrayal of Raymer have on you as you mulled over a sequel to Nobody's Fool? Because Raymer was not a central character in that first book.
No, he was kind of a functionary in
Nobody's Fool.
He was Sully's nemesis in that book. But, you know, in literary terms, he was kind of a pawn that I was moving around the chessboard to get some use out of. But, you know, as great actors often do, what's that old saying? There are no small roles, only small actors. You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman played that part. He owned that part as if it were, you know, as if he were the main character in the film. And despite the fact that he's only on screen for just a few minutes, they are very, very memorable minutes. And you know, we worked together on another movie, too, because he had a much more... he had a much larger role in the HBO miniseries Empire Falls, and I had a chance to meet him on the set there and saw him. Of course, by then he was very famous and generally recognized as kind of a national treasure of a writer. So when it came time to start Everybody's Fool. I love sequels where a minor character becomes the main character anyway. And I just, you know, Philip was very much in my mind. And I was 250 pages or so into this book when we got the news of his tragic death. So
what did that do to your work on the book and your thinking about the character? That must have been just a heck of a jolt.
Well, you know, it's odd because my first thought was that, all right, I mean, I wouldn't have just assumed that a movie would be made of Everybody's Fool, because, you know, it's always a long shot that any novel that you write will be made into a movie. So I wasn't thinking about it in those terms. And yet, you know, it's always kind of in the back of your mind that it's a possibility. And Philip, you know, there he was and he actually you know, as I was writing some of these scenes where Chief of Police Raymer gets into more and more trouble, and he's kind of throughout this novel until the very end, he's just circling the drain. And I just kept seeing, you know, I just had this idea that Philip would really understand this character. He himself, I know from Nobody's Fool and from the set of Empire Falls, that his heart just went out to people who were in trouble. You know, in real life, that's just the way he was. And so I kept seeing him. And when the news came that he had died, my first thought was, all right, well, I've got to start picturing, you know, somebody else. You know, it just became impossible. And at some point I thought, well, wait a second, that's crazy. He was doing such a good job of inspiring this character. Why would I try to imagine somebody else in this role? He'd just been such an inspiration to this point already.
Hey, you've described him as incredibly down to earth, just a great guy to hang with.
Philip?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I only met him a few times, but my friend Robert Benton, who was the director and screenwriter on Nobody's Fool, the wonderful movie that he did. Mm-hmm. When I heard that Philip had died, Benton was one of the first people that I called, and he was, you know, he was suffering Philip's loss as I was, and so many people in the industry were, and we got telling stories back and forth. And of course, Benton had saw an awful lot more of Philip than I did. But Benton told me several wonderful stories about Philip on the set of Nobody's Fool. He had a place in New York at the time. I'm not sure it was the same place in the West Village that he had later, but because the movie was filmed so close to New York, a lot of people would head home. There were a lot of New York-based actors there. Paul Newman, of course, had his house in Westport, Connecticut, and several of the other actors were New York-based. And when the weekend came along, these actors and you know, some of the tech people would just go home to the city. And Philip, who could have done that, would hang around because there were some of the actors and other kind of technical people were in Fishkill and Poughkeepsie and Beacon, where the movie was being shot, and they didn't have a home to go to. Philip used to hang around, and he had his car up there. And when things were going on, you know, everybody in the cast that was remaining was going to go out someplace to dinner. It was kind of Philip that made sure everybody had a ride there and had a way to get back to the hotel. This is the sort of thing that you do only if you care. And that was Philip's reputation really throughout the industry, was even as he became more and more famous, he just had that kind of heart, and he didn't get into character, or he didn't start thinking about other people only when he was on the set. I mean, that's just the way he was all the time.
Novelist Richard Russo is my guest. His latest book, Everybody's Fool. He joins us this morning from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio. He'll be in town tomorrow evening at 7, Tuesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To get a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126, or go to rainydaybooks.com. I'll put that number and that website out again later on here. You've said that Paul Newman came to own the character of Sully, Richard, even though Sully didn't look like Paul Newman. That's got to be a good feeling, having Paul Newman own a character of yours in Nobody's Fool.
Yeah. Paul was wonderful. And he didn't look. The guy that I described in Nobody's Fool probably looked more like, I don't know, Roy Scheider or somebody like that. Kind of a scrap iron. This was a guy who'd done, Sully had done hard physical labor all of his life. So I was expecting, you know, somebody certainly not nearly as good looking as Paul Newman. I was stunned to discover how good looking Sully really was on screen.
even though
I created him, I really had no idea. But the thing about the great actors is that they kind of overcome their own physicality and the first time that I met Paul, he was a 70-year-old playing a 60-year-old in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I met him on the set, he came. This was just a few days into the shoot, and he came limping toward me. And my thought was, "Oh, good Lord, look at this! We're only 2 days into the shoot, and he's hurt himself already." But he hadn't hurt himself. It wasn't Paul Newman that was limping; it was Sully, who'd fallen off a ladder in the novel. And I think Paul had always, in a way, I mean, he was so incredibly good looking, especially as a younger man. But my God, still at 70, he was still a bit of a heartthrob. And I think he spent a lot of his life kind of playing down his good looks and pretending through his characters like Sully and that wonderful lawyer in The Verdict. He always was to kind of rough himself up to be not as handsome as he was, and in some ways to transcend. I mean, anybody else would have been thrilled to have those looks. And I think with Paul, he was always trying to play them down and trying to, as I say, rough himself up. And
I can relate
to
so much of
that. He was a character actor. Yeah, we should all have that problem.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of the way. And he came in, and despite the fact that I didn't see him as Sully, when I started watching what they call the rushes, those early, you go in the morning and you see what they did yesterday. And here was a man who had just triumphed over his physicality in the role, and he saw him early on a scene between Sully and his son, and Sully is telling his trying to explain to his son why he left the family, and it's a very leisurely scene in which Newman, the camera, is just in a very, very, the camera is kind of creeping up, and we're looking at him through the window of his pickup truck, and it's raining, and the camera at the beginning kind of, as I recall, takes in both Sully and his son, but as the scene moves on, we get closer and closer to Sully, and there's a point at which where Sully is having a terrible time explaining why he's left his son and the family. And you're looking at him through the raindrops in the window, and the camera is literally his face just fills the screen, and he has this haunted look. And there's a point at which he becomes at a loss for words, and with his face filling the screen, it's his silence where you understand the backstory. When he can't explain anymore, it's his face that picks up the explanation how haunted he is.
Right.
Well, that's what the great ones do.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal, Richard, described the plot line of this new book, Everybody's Fool, this way: covering a period of less than 48 hours, it's a madcap romp weaving mystery, suspense, and comedy in a race to the final pages. What do you want to add to that?
Not a thing.
You'll take it just the way it was written.
We'll take that. I'm always delighted when people read my books and discover a plot in them. It's not my strong suit. It's not my strong suit as a writer. I generally start with a character that I don't mind spending the next 5 or 6 years with, and kind of turn them loose and hope that something like a plot will evolve. But I'm being a little bit glib here, because this book probably has more plot than there are a lot more narrative strands going in this book, and it is.
But still, I've read about you that you begin writing with absolutely no idea where the book is headed, and I just think that eventually becomes a whole lot of pressure, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and with
what have you gotten yourself into sometimes, I'm sure.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And since writing one novel doesn't help you write another, what happens with me, I've just learned that it's coming now, and I don't fret too much about it. But, you know, my books in TypeScript are generally 750 pages to 1,000 pages, around there. And you get up to around page 750 and you realize, I don't know how to end this book. To this point, you've gone on faith, and the sense that if you're still enjoying it, if the characters are still entertaining you, then you kind of assume that they will still be entertaining to readers. And yet, eventually, ultimately, you do come up against it at the end, and you say to yourself, is there an ending? Because I don't know what it is. And at some point, you're saying to yourself, all right, well, this is the one. I've finally bitten off more than I can chew. And this I'm going to have to, you know, just throw this away and start another book. And the last 5 years of my life have been in the service of idiocy. And very often at that point, you know, just to keep myself from falling into depression, I will put it aside and maybe write a draft of a screenplay or a couple stories or an essay or something. Let the back of my brain work on it and stop looking at it and stop looking at its problems. And then I come back to it after a month or 6 weeks of hiatus, and suddenly I think, oh, I see. And then I can write through to an ending. And the book is still a mess. And now I have to go back to the beginning again, but at least I know how the story ends. And then the final, you know, illusion, I think. The final illusion that any author wants is to go back and revise and make all the ducks, you know, line up and all pointing in the same direction. And the final illusion is for you and for other readers is to make it look like I knew what I was doing from the start.
But at that point, though, you're cutting what, 50-60% of your original batch of words. That's a lot.
It is, but I also but I add as many as I cut. I mean, I'm a ruthless reviser, and I will cut and cut and cut. But I'm also new things are occurring to me. So in those gaps, there's generally something new and interesting and worth investigating, and that's fun for me because, you know, without the sense of discovery, without the fun of learning new things, revision can be thankless. But new things are always occurring to me, even in, you know, draft 17.
You know, it's such an interesting idea you just threw out about walking away from your work for a period of time and letting your mind just sort of work on it, you know, quietly, and then you go back and you've gained some new perspective here. That's such an amazing thing about writing, and maybe it would help more people if they could just sort of walk away and then come back, and your perspective shifts, it changes, and suddenly you can go at it in a whole different way.
And, you know, it's a luxury that not many writers actually have, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an awful lot of writers, if you're writing in the genre if you're writing mysteries or thrillers or romances and you're lucky enough to have a good publisher, there's a very good chance that you're working under a deadline. And if you have basically a year to produce a book, you probably don't have 2 months of that year to walk away from it and let your subconscious do that kind of necessary
ruminating.
You know, yeah. If thinking is even the right word, but if you're under deadline like that, as you would be writing, say, a magazine piece or something like that, where you simply don't have that luxury to walk away. And one of the real blessings of my career, which is now longer than I ever dreamed it would be, is that I have a publisher, and more particularly an editor, who just wants the next book to be good, and never calls to say, how are things going? Where are you?
Yeah.
What page are you on? When do you think you'll be delivering the book? And
right.
That's just my editor has never wanted that kind of reassurance. You know, there'd be a great place for it on the spring list. Do you think you can make the spring list? You know, he just wants it to be good. And so over the years, you know, if it takes 5 years, if it takes 6 years, well, fine. Give it to me when it's good.
Do you ever call him just to chat?
Just to find out if he's still my editor.
He's still there? The company's
still there? If he's not bugging you about the book, the other possibility is that really it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
he's fallen in love with another writer or something like that. But that's never the case.
Richard, you know, who?
He's giving me the necessary rope,
yeah,
I guess.
Writer Richard Russo is my guest. You find a lot of material, I've read, in the local police log where you live, and you and a fellow writer named Howard Frank Mosher send each other these clips from the local police log back and forth. Why do you do that, and what do you learn?
Well, I mean, it's just a great place to witness a certain kind of lunacy. The great thing about the police log is that it catches people in these truly wonderful moments. Some of them are just crazy, and they're doing stuff that they wouldn't do if they thought about it even for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get these nutty things. And this particular book, Everybody's Fool, has two or three things in it that actually I took from some of the police logs that Howard sent me. There's one point at which Raymer has to go to this house to apprehend a man who has a wife and several feral children and several vicious dogs, and Raymer is bitten by everybody in the family except the wife, who doesn't have any teeth. And, you know, all of that lunacy came directly from that particular police log. But the other thing you see, and I do love this, is I count myself among people who do things like this all the time, is that you see sometimes in these logs and other things you find in your local paper, you find instances where somebody has done something small wrong. And he or she gets caught up in that, and you're embarrassed because you've done something really stupid and perhaps even marginally illegal. But it's no big thing. But then you try to cover it up because you don't want to look like an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And the cover-up, of course, makes it worse.
Right, right.
And the whole thing was worth a penny to begin with, but then you just make it worse and worse and worse. And pretty soon all the money that you've got, you've invested a penny here, a nickel there, a dime there, a quarter there. Pretty soon there's $100 of your money in the pot, and you're still trying to cover things up. And that's at least the stuff of what my novels are made out of. People making small errors and then compounding them.
Wasn't there some story you got out of a police log, or at least talked about a guy sitting up in a tree with a chainsaw?
Yes.
and he's cutting the branch,
yes,
and it's the branch that's going to take him down to the ground.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that was actually from, that wasn't in a police log. That was just something somebody told me in a dinner party or something. But it did end up in the book. And it was one of the first things I told Howard Frank Mosier, because he was always asking of news of Rub and Sully. And I never had any to give him. But yeah, it was this guy he was waiting for a friend of his to come over and help him lop off a tree limb that was scratching against his wife's bedroom window, and the guy didn't show up. And so this guy went and got a length of rope and his chainsaw, and he tied one end of the rope to the handle of the chainsaw and the other end to his belt, and then climbed up into the tree, about 30 feet up into the tree, sat on the limb that he was going to prune with the chainsaw, with his back to the tree trunk. You have to kind of envision this, you know, with his back to the tree trunk. He hauls up the chainsaw by means of the rope, actually fires it, you know, spreads his leg as far as he can, fires up the chainsaw, prunes the limb, and then lowers the chainsaw back to the ground, unhitches the chainsaw from the rope from his belt.
Mm-hmm.
And only then contemplates where he is. he's mission accomplished, but he's now stuck
up in
the tree, because in order to rotate on that branch, he's now sitting on a nub, and there's no branch above him, and his back is to the tree, so he can't grab the tree trunk from behind him.
Yeah.
And he hasn't imagined that without the tree trunk that he has pruned, there's no way to rotate himself on that nub that he's sitting on. And he sat up there, according to the guy that told me this story, he sat up there like 4 hours. He did this at around noon, and of course he had to wait for his wife to come home from work at 5:30. Just imagine sitting in a sitting 30 feet off the ground on a tree limb that you really can't even change your position all that much.
And that's what you get from the police logs, right?
That's the kind of stuff that you get from that just delight Howard Frank Mosier and me, yeah, anyway. Maybe nobody else, but
Richard, just one final thing.
We live for things like that. Yeah.
Just one final thing. I just was interested in asking, why so much interest in ordinary people in your books? And you know, why not, you know, when you write about royalty, there's a natural interest. Why ordinary folks?
Well, all I can say is that they interest me.
Mm.
You know, everybody's a fool in this book, hence the title. And I think,
and I think
we all are at various times in our lives, but ordinary people have sometimes lead, I think, extraordinary lives. I think Sully's life is extraordinary. It was it's based in large part, I've never made any bones about this, upon my own father's life. And my father was a D-Day guy. Utah Beach, and Sully is a D-Day guy.
Right.
And like my father, he made it through the hedgerows and the Hürtgen Forest in Germany and made it all the way to Berlin, and lost a lot of people along the way, and came home to a small town in upstate New York. You know, the pictures of him going off to war and the pictures of him returning from war don't even look like the same man. And here's a man still in his mid-20s, who has the rest of his life in front of him, and it's a life of hard manual labor and bar stools and cheap beer, and he lives that life, as does Miles Roby in Empire Falls and Lucy Lynch in Bridge of Sighs, with, I think, great character and without many of the comforts of enough money, enough love, enough recognition, all those things. And my characters tend to live, I think, quietly, heroically.
Richard Russo's latest book, Everybody's Fool. He'll be in town tomorrow evening at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To get a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126, or go to rainydaybooks.com. And Richard, what a pleasure to have you. Really enjoyed the book, and wish you all the best with it.
Thanks, Steve.
You bet.